As a trial lawyer, I just want to hold insurance companies accountable for mistakes that they've made, and whether it's intentional or not intentional or whatever, or gross negligent. I want to do it the right way so that I'm being honest with the client. If I was in a position to where I would need a lawyer, I just want someone that's going to be very honest and straightforward, but just know what they're doing.
My view as a trial lawyer would be, it's about compassion and it's about the personal. In a lot of ways, I think of this as a Goldilocks job, knowing that I had a material impact helping a family. That's my view on what it means to be a trial lawyer.
Welcome to Trial Lawyer View, the podcast dedicated to the fierce yet compassionate lawyers who fight every day for justice in the courtroom. Our guests are top trial lawyers and their firms who share their stories and experiences, offering valuable insights into their journey, as well as expert guests who provide actionable strategies and practical tips for personal injury lawyers looking to optimize their operations, enhance client service, and drive growth in their practices. Trial Lawyer View is brought to you by Synergy. At Synergy, we aren't just a service provider. We are a strategic partner for personal injury law firms, seamlessly integrating with law firms to boost efficiency from day one. Outsourcing cumbersome administrative tasks like lien resolution and Medicare compliance to an expert partner like Synergy enables personal injury firms to focus on what they do best.
Welcome to the Trial Lawyer View podcast. In this episode, I'm lucky enough to have two incredible trial lawyers join me to talk trial lawyer shop. First is David Casey III, who's a third generation attorney with Casey Jerry, the oldest plaintiff's law firm in San Diego, founded by his grandfather in 1947. Second is Eric Ganti, a dedicated civil trial attorney at Casey Jerry, bringing a wealth of experience and passion to the field of personal injury law. With a robust background that includes over 70 trials during his solo practice defending impaired driving cases, Eric has honed his skills in advocacy and client representation. His commitment to the legal community extends beyond his practice. He's been actively involved with the Trial Lawyers College, educating fellow attorneys across the country on trial techniques. A professional musician and certified yoga instructor, he balances his legal career with his passion for music and wellness, embodying a well-rounded approach to both life and law. Today, we explore trial preparation strategies, including evidence tracking and creating narratives to influence the jury. We also touch upon technology use in the practice of law. David and Eric, welcome to Trial Lawyer View, and thank you for being with me today on the podcast.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
David, I'll start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and what brings you to the podcast today?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I'm an attorney over here at Casey Jerry. We're a personal injury firm in San Diego. And, my name is David Casey III. You might sense that there's some connection there with Casey Jerry. This is a firm that my grandfather started back in the 1940s. And my dad then followed in his footsteps, and I followed in my dad's footsteps as well. So, third generation personal injury lawyer over here in San Diego, kind of born and raised out here, tried doing a couple of other things, because a fair amount of pressure, going into that sort of situation. But in the end, I decided to kind of, return to the fold and, kind of follow in that family tradition. And I absolutely love what I do. I've been doing this for about 5 years now.
Well, having done some research for the podcast, I know about the incredible legendary status of your grandfather and all the things that your dad has accomplished, and also what the firm has done in terms of results for the people that you guys serve in San Diego and beyond. So very impressive what's been built, and cool to see you following into that legacy of serving the injured population in San Diego and beyond. Very, very cool that you get that opportunity to work with your dad, but also in the same firm that your grandfather built.
Thank you so much for that. That's absolutely how I feel. I mean, it's really a lucky and fortunate kind of position to be in, and it's a real privilege and honor to be able to serve this community. I really couldn't imagine doing anything else.
Yeah, I bet. So, Eric, I wanted to ask you, because you've got kind of this unique background outside of your legal practice. You've got this passion for drumming and music, which is evident. You're also a certified yoga teacher, So kind of a bit of a renaissance man. as a musician, a wellness kind of person and trial attorney, how do you balance those outside pursuits with the demands of practicing law? And in what ways do you think your background enriches your practice?
Yeah. Well, that's a such a small question to answer. it also
podcast up for just on that, probably.
Yeah, exactly. Let me know if I'm talking still into tomorrow. It also assumes that I got it figured out, that I have a balance going on. Some days are definitely better than others. You know, it's, I think it all kind of blends together. And a lot of the yoga thing for me is about being present, and that has so much to do with being a trial lawyer and then being like present with the jurors, being present with the situation that's happening, being, I'm really into like energy. So being present, like what's the energy in the room kind of a thing. Just to be able to understand it. And so many lawyers, we are so like linear where we're like, you know, and I think about this, like my earlier trials that I would do where I would just be focused on the witness that's happening over here and then not have any idea that this audience over here is like rolling their eyes or frustrated or excited or whatever, what's going on. So just to be able to like take it and just expand that universe to be able to understand that like we are just one piece of like this event that's happening, which is like, you know, the trial that's going on, or if it's like a deposition or if it's a mediation or a focus group or whatever. So there's a lot of that, that goes into place. The music thing too is very similar, where it's like being up on stage, and Dave, you can comment to this too, because Dave plays bass. It's an energy that you can create on stage, but then it's also being aware of like who, like what your audience is keying into or not keying into. And it makes me think of, you know, one time I was doing a drum solo and, I start playing drums, and like a few minutes into my drum solo, the entire band walks off the stage and then everyone at the bar turns around and starts ordering drinks. And then I'm like, hey, you know, they're clearly missing a killer drum solo that's happening up here. But then once I take a big step back from that, it's like, well, what's happening and what am I trying to express? And is it attainable for the audience? And, you know, what's going to make them engaged in what's happening? So there's a theater component to that, and not saying that, you know, when we're doing our trials, it's the most important part of what's happening is everyone else but us, but the lawyer. But we need to be aware that we are a piece of that. And if we try to take too much of that on ourselves, then that can really just shift like the focus around in a little bit different ways. But there's a whole lot of, there's just a lot that goes on with all of that. I don't know if I'm answering that question, or Dave, if you have other thoughts about how music can kind of play into being a lawyer.
No, absolutely. And I, you know, Eric's nice to say that I play music. You know, I played bass when I was, you know, in high school, and played in college with a couple of bands. Eric still has a group, rock and roll karaoke, right, Eric?
Yeah, rock and roll karaoke. Yeah.
That still tours and plays around San Diego and other places. They're absolutely fantastic. Eric has always been great about, getting me out to, you know, he's always inviting me to go see concerts and go to shows and, you know, talk about that aspect of life that is outside of the practice. And I really do think that is so important. Eric, you've helped keep me grounded with some of this stuff, so I really appreciate that. You know, I do think that really does help the practice. But yeah, I mean, absolutely, being on stage like that, learning how the audience is responding to you, I do think a lot of that carries over from the stage into the courtroom.
Yeah. Do you, Jason, are you a musician as well, or an enjoyer of going out and seeing the arts?
I love music, love going to concerts. My better half, she's also a yoga teacher, which is, I do a fair bit of yoga myself because of that. Anyway, that's why I wanted to ask about that too, but she's always got a schedule going to concerts, which I love. I do not have a single bone in my body that is artistic. And I tried to learn guitar when I was younger, and then I had made a pact that I would learn to play by the time I was 50, got the guitar, and then COVID hit, and then haven't gone back. It's sitting in the corner of my home office, and it's on a stand, so I have to look at it all the time, because at some point I'm going to learn. But I unfortunately don't know how to play any instruments. And my better half, she's also incredible singer, plays the piano, incredibly musical. And so, and every now and then when I sing in the car, she's like, oh my God, you have zero ability. Like, yeah, sorry.
Yeah. You know, it takes me back to, there was a, I'm a big fan of like in music, it's like there's practicing, and I used to be a music teacher. So it's like there's practicing and then there's performing. And I think back to during COVID times, I was learning, I too was trying to learn how to play guitar and learning how to speak Spanish a little better. But I would use the morning hours of like between 4:30 and 5 because I get up super early, and I would use that to like play guitar and practice singing Spanish. And then my partner Jen, she says, you don't sound very good when you play. And I said, well, yeah, it's because I'm practicing. I'm not supposed to sound good while I'm practicing. She said, that's great. Can you not do it at 4:30 in the morning? I said, yeah, that's a fair point. She's like, I'm just trying to like have some coffee and enjoy a little bit of quiet time. I'm like, yeah, that's a fair point. Yeah, we could do that.
Yeah, that's very fair, especially knowing how I sounded when I was, you know, just starting to learn some of the chords and practicing. It's I get so inspired by music. So it's funny that I just have no commitment to learning it, because it is for me. Yeah, I've been a cyclist all my life, and I would always use music when I trained, using open ear so I can hear what's going around, but still having that music because I feel like I need that. And even I also, connection here, I like to go fast, so I also race cars and sort of not wheel to wheel, but so when I'm out on track, I will listen to something that's kind of up tempo or motivating to perform. So it's interesting how music can really help you in that regard.
Oh yeah, well, and there's a lot to be said about tempo, and if you're presenting evidence or like cross-examining people, something that's really neat, and I think of this a lot as being like a theater director, that we're putting together a play and we get to like star in it and direct it, kind of. Although I use that term star in it, because really, if you, the lawyer, think that you're the star of the trial, then you've got something going wrong, and then jurors will punish you for that. But how much you can really control the dialogue just by like pausing, taking space. And that's something that when Dave and I are like just working with the clients about understanding, like at a deposition, for example, like if you get asked a question, you get to control of when the answer is being given. And if you want to try to speed it up, you can lean into that. But if you want to slow things down, you can do that too, just by simply taking a pause, just like taking a breath and just sitting and thinking with something. Or, you know, other things too, like volume, like talking quieter, talking louder, and how that can have a reaction on people. It's really, I mean, all of the musical pieces of just life, it really comes into play with so much of what we do as lawyers.
Well, that energy too, like you talked about, what energy do you bring and how do you bring it? And yeah, you know, sure that ties in somewhat with the yoga stuff too, but the musical, I hadn't really thought about that, but it does make sense in terms of, you know, that, how that gets conveyed ultimately to the jury in terms of your style and how you're, you know, helping your clients best, you know, put their case to the jury.
Yeah. I also think, Dave, what's your thoughts on this? Because one of the things that I like about going out and seeing music is that it's a way to be able to connect with people, either by watching the show or just being around other people, but not have to like talk with them. And that's a performance thing too. I like playing with the band, and I can communicate just with like by playing or like eye movements or whatever. And that is because we spend so much of our day like talking and writing and like lawyering stuff, but to not have to rely on that and just to enjoy other beings, like spaces of being. I don't know, Dave, like, what do you, any thoughts on that?
I completely agree. I mean, I spent so much of, especially when I was younger, I mean, I think I was at shows every single weekend. I lived at the Shea Cafe or Soma. Anyone from San Diego who was growing up, you know, these venues, this is where all the punk and the indie bands were playing. And even to this day, I do it a little bit less now. Part of that is I've got, you know, I've got an 8-month-old daughter at home. So, you know, I look forward to when we can start bringing her to shows. Although inevitably, I'm sure her musical taste will be defined by whatever it is that I'll try to get her to listen to something. She'll be like, that's not cool. I'll be like, no, but listen, that stuff was great. But yeah, I mean, that ability to connect when you're not, you know, but it doesn't, just experiencing those same things with other people. I kind of think also of, I don't know, there's two things that come to mind. What you were talking about, Jason, with like racing, you know, I've kind of become a runner over the past year or so. Eric's nice enough to follow me on Strava and we give each other thumbs up on there. I think Strava is one of the nicest social media apps, I gotta say.
No, yeah, for sure. Cause I'm on it for cycling and it's funny that, you know, that they've created that community around that, which is great. Very supportive.
It's incredible, right? Like it's something about like those little, like just the thumbs up or the kudos or just seeing what other people are doing. There's something so motivating about it. You know, there have been times where, you know, maybe I don't want to get out and do something, but I see that, like, you know, Eric went on a great run and I'm like, all right, well, I got to get out there. Yeah. That thing with tempo and pace. And I do think that draws back to taking depositions, just like Eric was saying. I mean, that's something that I really struggled with earlier. I think I still do, about not getting too caught up in what I'm doing, really focusing on, like, you know, how my body language, how what I'm saying can really kind of control the vibe of the room, the way that conversation is going. Mm-hmm. And I also think that just having those experiences of, like, you know, I just got back from this incredible trip to Japan, where we visited one of the things we did was visited, they're called like the Art Islands of Japan. They're about 15 minutes by ferry, kind of south of Okayama on the west coast. And there's just these incredible contemporary art museums there, and just going to them. And they're truly mind blowing. The museum was called the Chichu Museum, Chichu, and experiencing that art with other people, not really talking, but just having that same experience. It was really incredible.
The things that we were going to talk about and focus on today was a lot around trial strategy. I'm curious, Eric, particularly, because you have a bit of a unique background in that you had over 70 trials in the area of defending impaired drivers. And I'm curious how that has translated into your current practice in terms of key lessons that you learn from those experiences that you bring into the courtroom now.
Yeah, so lots. I'll see if I can toss out a few. I think that one of the biggest ones is an understanding that when you're at trial, it's never a matter of what happened. It's a matter of what can be proven that happened. And when I was doing criminal defense, there was a lot of like lawyering that happened, that some evidence, it didn't come in to the trial on either side. Either the prosecution was trying to get in or the defense was trying to get in, and then it didn't get in. And so just having an understanding of like, well, the jurors, they're just there for whatever, like a week or two. And so they just get what they're going to get. Like, this is the movie that they get to watch. And then they make a very big decision based on that. So it's taking a big step back of understanding that once we get into a case, like what evidence is actually going to come in. And so many times we work with clients and they're like, well, that's not true. That's not, you know, this is what someone said. And of course, as soon as someone says, well, like, that's what someone said, like, is there like a hearsay thing that comes into that? So then once we have the eye on the prize of like what it is that we're going to present at the end of the case, then it's about what do we want to put together along the way so that we can then see what evidence it is that we want to be able to input in front of the trial so that we can tell an objective story and then be able to tell our client's story. And it was a little different doing criminal defense because I was, you know, obviously trying to defend a case criminally. But on the plaintiff side, it's we now have the burden, or I should say I, because it's before doing criminal defense, but now working with Casey Geary for the past 5 years and just having an awareness of thinking like a defense lawyer, like how would I be trying to like put out evidence across the way? So like, how do we lock things in to be able to get things, be able to present it at the trial? So, but then also like educating the client of this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to try to put it together. And then knowing that there's so many rules with civil litigation about like how to take depositions and like all these different rules of evidence. So like, how do we put all that stuff together? So then that way, when we are at trial, that we know that hopefully everything's going to go as we planned it to go. And then also that the client understands this is what we're trying to do. Here's what the other side's going to argue. And that's another big thing too. And something that we're here to tell our client's story, but we're also here to be objective, to be able to understand like what it is, like what happens if this evidence doesn't come in? What happens if the jurors believe the defendant's story more than the plaintiff's story? Like, and how do we set up the case, not just to tell the story and prove the case, but also to educate the client of like, here's a realistic view of like things that could happen with one of these cases. So yeah, there's just a lot that goes into it. And just having been through a lot of trials, it's really honed the skills on that, hopefully.
Yeah, I bet. Well, so backing up a second, how do you guys evaluate cases to forecast whether it's likely to go to trial or not? And then how do you prepare your team for that potentiality when you're talking about these cases that you guys handle day to day?
Yeah, good question. Dave, you have initial thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, that was one. See, that's where I'll say something and turn it back to you, because I know that you've been able to get some of these cases to trial. I'd say that, you know, it's interesting because there's so many, you know, it's a phenomenon that I think we all know that it gets pretty hard to get a case to trial these days. I mean, you know, we really try, but, you know, when you keep pushing and pushing, I mean, it seems like it often they will just end in, what I mean, 99% of them end in settlement. And, you know, so, but it's true that, I mean, I've got a couple that are lined up right now. I mean, what are the things that you would go to that, you know, whether a case is set up well for that or not? I mean, of course, you know, if you got a big liability issue, if you have, you know, or something I've seen recently where, you know, you have clients who have tried to maybe handle the case a bit themselves and they, you know, they've made a demand, it doesn't go anywhere. And then you kind of come in, maybe have an open policy situation. But I'm getting a bit into the weeds. I mean, you've gotten a couple of cases to trial over here, Eric, in the past couple of years. I mean, what was it with those that you think like where those got pushed there as opposed to, you know, finding another result?
I think it depends on a bunch of different things, but I think that a lot of with plaintiff lawyers that sometimes the injuries like drive the case. And then if you get a case that has like a really severe injury, then plaintiff lawyers just assume, I think wrongfully, that the defense is just going to cave. And if you get good defense lawyers on the other side, you know, good luck is what I can say with that. And
I can say, I just got off a phone call where I have that exact situation. Yeah. Sometimes you think you can tie it all with a little bow and be like, look, I mean, we got, my guy needs surgery. What are we doing? And, you know, they just say like, yeah, well, we're not paying you, you know, what do we do?
And that will start the conversation of insurance companies and the psychology of how they use money to like what I think is a really abusive practice. I have lots of thoughts on that, but I'll take a pause on that. But it's, you know, if we get into a case and we're like typical things that can affect how we should know that a defense is going to approach a case. So like if the client has like pre-existing injuries, or if they are perhaps like later on in years to where they have like other just typical injuries that the defense can hide behind the medical records and say like, oh, it wasn't this crash that caused whatever. It wasn't this incident that caused it. It was like because they had degenerative, you know, disease of some kind. Okay, well, they didn't have these pains before. So but educating the client, this is what we're going to do. And this is how we need to prepare against this. But also liability. You know, I always I think it's funny when a plaintiff lawyer, then when they get into a case and then, you know, 6 months later or a year later, they're like, they get served with an MSJ and they're like, whoa, I can't, you know, now I got all this work to do. I'm like, what did you think was going to happen with this case when it came into your door? Like, you should know, that if you're dealing with certain types of cases, like premises type cases, like they're probably going to go down this issue of like these types of issues, just be ready for that. And then if you need to be ready for that, like start preparing for that stuff so that you can be taking depositions and then you can try to stay ahead of that. So then when you get the MSJ, you can be like, okay, I've been preparing for this. I've been following the law on it. These are the questions I've been asking in the depositions is based on this like set of case law. So then it becomes just a part of the practice of like, we know that we're dealing with good defense lawyers. This is what they should be doing because they're trying to protect their client. Even though their client's the insurance company, and I'm rolling my eyes as I say that, but you know, how do we just know that's part of the process. Okay, so let's put this together. So, but then when you have all that, then we have to look at like, well, what case list do we have and what size of a shop are you? you know, we're at Casey Gary, like we have a lot of really fantastic, very powerful support staff. But if you're running, like, if you're in a firm that's like, you know, 300 lawyers, that may feel different. If you're like a solo lawyer, you know, that may feel different. And what kind of resources do you want to do to get into it? And that may direct whether or not you want to take the case or whether or not you want to co-counsel with the case with other people. You know, there's, but just, I think that it's come from lots of difficult lessons of trial and error of just knowing that when a case comes in, just to understand, like, let's take a big step back, and which I keep saying over and over again, but it's like, just really, like, let's look at the forest so that we can just understand. And if we are going to get into a case that is going to be a really complex case, what kind of resources are we going to be using to be able to pursue that type of case versus it's like a car crash case that's a clear liability rear ender type of case. But then we know that there's some pre-existing, so we need to protect against that. So, and there's lots of thoughts then about, you know, how do you want to serve a demand? And, you know, so many lawyers serve a demand starting higher to get to let themselves get walked down. That's one way to do it. Sometimes you can serve a demand that's lower to then say, this is it. Like, I'm giving you a discount, take it or leave it. And if you don't take it, I'm going to go to trial. But, you know, if you're going to say that, you better stick to it. Because, yeah, what's your thoughts on that, Dave?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely. I mean, that's really part of the practice that I have learned from Eric. One thing I want to give and what I want to give you a shout out on, Eric, is the way he's so methodical in how he prepares his cases. That's something I've really learned from you, is doing that heavy lifting early on can make such a difference, because, you know, it can be easy to let things fall to the wayside. It can be easy to focus on like the two or three cases that, you know, are kind of on fire and let other things just kind of go. But when you're methodically moving each case along, because it turns out defense lawyers, they also have a ton of cases. And if you're the one who's really pushing them, if you're showing them that you're on it, I can think of multiple incredible results that, that Eric's gotten this year, where through his method of just keeping that pressure on, of playing really smart discovery, really smart offense, his clients have benefited massively. So I think I've been mixing the third person and the second person there. But yes, Eric, you did a great job.
We're doing it all together.
Well, so the key takeaway from that, I think, at least what I'm hearing you guys talk about, is evaluating the cases at the outset for the strategy and then being methodical about your approach to how you actually execute on that strategy to be prepared ultimately for what's to come.
Yeah. And then also comes by, it's like, I see it sometimes as tests too, because it's not, what's interesting being on the plaintiff side is that we have the defense lawyer that we're dealing with, and there's psychology that's on that end, but then we also have the adjuster that's on the other side. And like, and I've had plenty of cases where I think that the defense lawyer wants to settle the case, but then it seems like they're having client control issues where they're not able to talk with the adjuster. And then, you know, adjusters, like, what do they care about? They care about, you know, counting beans, like the money. And then they keep data, from what I understand, on everybody. So then if I act one way with this adjuster this time, now I have a file on myself, maybe, or maybe I won't, maybe I'm flattering myself too much that they keep files on us. But so then when I get into this adjuster next time, and maybe I have approached a case one way because it's, there were certain things to do with that way, but then but the psychology across the board is just so fascinating. But that's why when, if you take the approach of like, I'm going to serve a demand, and if you pay it, great, and make it a reasonable demand if that's what you want to do, or at least that's what I would want to do. But that also comes with a conversation to the client of, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it. And if we don't do it, then the plan is going to be like, you know, we're storming the beaches of Normandy and we're not stopping. And then they can come find us. And especially if we've opened the policy, which I have a handful of open policy cases right now where I gave them a chance to settle. They didn't, for whatever reason. One, they, you know, some of them, they just blew the time limit on it. And the other ones that they thought that that the case wasn't worth it. Okay. But then once you do that, then it's like full throttle, you know, we'll see at the finish line kind of a thing. But then it's having things set up so that, you know, there's so much paperwork in the civil end, like in criminal, it'd be like, I'd get a client, and then it would be like, okay, your case is probably going to go to trial in like 3 to 4 months. And then that's what would happen. In criminal, it's like, see you in court in a year and a half kind of a thing. But being able to put the paperwork together so that once you're starting to, you know, need to put together your trial reports and all the paperwork that goes along with it, that we're just ready to roll with that stuff. So lots of work, but it's, it's so fascinating to put all this stuff together. The psychology is just unreal.
Great point on the adjusters, though. And I, having done insurance defense work, that's what I did, you know, out of law school. And I just remember kind of one of the final nails in the coffin when I was making the decision to get out of doing that type of litigation was dealing with some of the adjusters, because some of the decisions were even driven by just seem like personal feelings over this particular claim, and, you know, not even making decisions for rational reasons when I was making a recommendation, maybe we want to resolve this, you know, and instead fighting them. It just, that part of it is the wild card in this.
Yeah. And I'm seeing it right now a lot with psychological injuries, where if you have, like, someone is involved in like a crash or an incident or whatever, and then the last thing that the plaintiff wants, like the plaintiff used many times just wants the case to be over. But then as soon as the defense adjuster gets sight of that, then they're just like, then they sink in their teeth. So then what can they do? Well, then they can lowball the offer. And, you know, Jason, you probably saw this then doing defense work. And it's like, God, and all we want to do when that stuff happens is like stand up and try to protect the person that's just being abused. But how do you protect the person? And that's that you stand up to the other side and, like, you know, you punch the bully in the nose. But that comes back to, Dave, your point of like, so many cases don't go to trial, or so many law firms aren't set up to go to trial. But in my opinion, like, that's the only way to really get these people to take you seriously is like, you go to trial, and of course we want to win, but even if you go to trial and you get your, like, just completely destroyed, as long as you're prepared and doing it the right way, like, they still take notice of that stuff too. And I think back to doing criminal, and like, there was one period where, you know, I don't like to think about it too much, but I'd lost like 6 trials in a row. And then I showed up like, after, you know, for trial number 7, and they're like, you're going to get back into the ring. And I'm like, boy, it's hard to do. But, you know, like, when you have that, they're like, they either respect you or they think that you're crazy. both can be effective, you know, sometimes. But, you know, it's just about standing up for what you think is right, but also having the case set up so that when it comes time to stand up to do that, then it's like, it's going to be a strong stance. And the client is educated and understand what's happening so that when the abuse starts happening, especially with these emotional injuries, then it's just like, no, we're going to stand up. We're going to do the thing that we think is right. And the only way to hit these insurance companies is really to hit them in their pocketbook. And then, you know, but it hit them and hit them hard. So then next time, if you come at some that you want to be reasonable, that then you have armed the defense lawyer, maybe if you have a good relationship, that they could be like, no, this person is sincere with what they're doing and they have the financial background. You know, that's a whole nother topic of, you know, to be able to have the financing to be able to, and the time resources to be able to push a case.
When you guys know that a case is headed for trial, how do you guys ensure that all relevant evidence is tracked and being prepared for trial, and how do you use that proactively to keep the defense ultimately on the defensive and the plaintiff on the offense?
Yeah, great question. I know that I have a method and it changes constantly. Dave, do you have initial thoughts?
Well, you have such a great setup for how you do these things, Eric. I think you should share it. Like, because I've learned a lot from how you set these things up.
Like, I do a color coding system, and it's also just reading everything that comes through. And like, we were on a case recently where it was like 15,000 pages of like emails on, and like, whoa, you know, that, but all that stuff, like, where do you find the key piece of evidence? It's usually on page 11,423. That's like one statement that says whatever. So just going through it, and I just have a way of tracking all the information and then a color coding system. So then these Word documents that I track everything in, you know, they end up being hundreds of pages. And then I just color code it with different stuff, like green is for good, red is for something that I think the defense will argue against us. So then I can just scroll through the document and just understand this is what we're looking at. So then when it comes time to, we're going to file a motion in limine to try to keep something out, I can roll through and look for the red stuff. Or if I need to prepare a client for their deposition, go through, look for the red stuff. This is what they're going to ask you about. Let's talk about that. And let's talk about why it is that, you know, what happened with that. Is there an explanation for it? So, but it's a lot of information to be able to put together. So, Dave, I don't know if you have further thoughts or.
I think that the way that you do it, I mean, this is where, I mean, I'll, so my trial experience is limited to the, I got to have a 6-week period where I was a volunteer deputy DA down here in Chula Vista in San Diego. And I actually got it to be second chair on two misdemeanors and a felony case. It was really, really cool. But, despite me pushing and trying, despite me almost getting there, I'm still looking for that for a civil trial. That doesn't mean that I don't still track the cases, that I don't have the same approach that Eric does, which is so, I mean, you're so incredibly methodical in how you do it. It's really incredible. Because I feel like almost any question can be thrown at you and you immediately have a response for it because you just have access to all this information in one place. It's frankly aspirational. As some of these cases, I've got one that might be going in a couple of months. As we get closer, I think that that's what I'm going to be taking some inspiration from.
Oh, cool. Well, Jason, we can ask you the same question. Like, how is it? Cause your team is so like educated, on like all the different ways of like lean negotiations. Like how is it that you started that and how did you get your team on board to be able to have that knowledge base?
Well, I mean, we are very lucky to have a lot of people from the other side who have that experience, the inside baseball, having worked with the recovery contractors that we face off against and that many law firms decide to face off against on their own, not knowing that, you know, these companies like Rawlings has thousands of people and they were sold to a private equity firm for God knows how much recently when Mr. Rawlings died. But, you know, these companies have deep teams and their job is every day like the defense and the insurance side of on your side of the fence to make sure that the plaintiff gets as little as possible, you know, and our context, it's, you know, they're trying to recover 100% of what was paid when that's not realistic, given the fact that maybe there's a limited recovery, which happens pretty frequently. I know you know that. So, you know, for us, it's having a team that understands how to, you know, navigate all of the difficult issues when you're dealing with these recovery contractors, but also knowing the nuances in terms of different types of liens and the law that may be applicable to them. So it's not really all that different from the way you guys go about your methodical approach. We have a very methodical approach to how those cases get resolved with the lien holders. And that's all about understanding how the other side operates and using that on the offense. So like, you know, what I was asking about, like, how do you keep the defense on the defensive and be on the offense? Well, that's, you know, we're using those kinds of tactics in the negotiation process.
It's such a good point of like keeping the best offense is a smart offense. And that's something that we see with our firm a lot is when plaintiff lawyers start playing defense as opposed to playing offense, like then something's wrong.
That's when we get in trouble.
Uh-huh. Because then you're not pushing your case forward at all. You're just answering to the other side. And if you're in that position, you're usually dealing with a defense lawyer that's really good on the other side because they know that if you can get a plaintiff lawyer spinning, like that just doesn't let them progress their case.
Yeah. Well, so when you guys go through this process, Eric, that you talked about and look at it, how do you then put that evidence together with the case to come up with a compelling narrative to the case? And how do you then get the jury bought in and influencing them in terms of the ultimate decision making? Because this is always, to me, such an interesting part of trial practice, particularly having been involved in a personal injury case myself, because I got to see some of it in a way that I had never seen it before. But I'm curious, you know, that process, how do you put the story together ultimately to make the jurors act?
Yeah, good question. And I'll give a shout out to Noah Moss, who's in our office, that we have talked with him a ton about just the art of putting stories together And there's so many great books on that subject. And then and there's different psychology of like how it is that you want to tell the story. Like, do you want to start with the plaintiff story? Do you want to start with the defense story? And also, we have a lot of experience within the Trial Lawyers College at this firm too. Dave has experience with them. I have experience with them. I teach with TLC. And so there's a lot of psychology about when you're presenting the story, like which ways do you want to present it? But then taking all the evidence, like here's comes the logistical side. And here's where like my Virgo brain comes in, is that you've now tracked all the evidence. And I just keep a running like Word document of any time that something I think is really important within the story, then I just plug it into, like, it's as simple as just plugging it into a Word document. And I know that I want the different arcs of the story of what to happen. And so then I plug it in. I have a citation so I can find it easily within the case file. Or if I know that I want like a witness to talk about a certain thing, that's the person that I'm going to call. But it's just like keeping a running narrative. Like, this is how we're going to tell the story with that. But that includes impeachment too, to be able to have the impeachment evidence ready. So that comes with like putting together a cross-examination so that when you're getting ready to like set up the sexy part of the cross-examination, you know, right when you get to the piece where you're going to about ready to impeach the person, like you have to have the impeachment evidence ready, because we've all seen it or been around it or something where it's like you go to impeach the person and then they're like, well, let me direct you to your deposition. And then just give me a second to find what page and line. And then before then, you know, the jurors are at the front of their seat with the popcorn ready to go. And then if you take too long, then they're like, oh, you know, you lost your time on that. So it's just as simple as just putting it together in like a running log.
The tactics for Trial Lawyer College and some of the other, you know, different methods that are out there, to me is very interesting study of the influence of people. And, you know, that art is an incredible area that, to me, you just keep seeing more and more focus on that to make sure that trial lawyers are able to really influence, which is, you know, ultimately what your goal is, to get that jury panel influenced in terms of what the desired outcome is for your client.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What makes people tick? What makes them act? And so much of the plaintiff side, so many of the cases that we deal with are such gnarly injuries that it's like, if I'm a juror and if I don't have experience with a death in the family or like a really incredible disfigurement or something like that, if I'm a juror, like that may be so much for me to take on right away. It may be hard for me to understand like dealing with that, step one, but then also like how, if I'm being asked to return a verdict to like compensate for that, then, you know, how do I deal with that? And so that's just the emotions, the psychological piece of it. Like it's, and Dave, like you're such a good read on like people and personalities. Like Dave just has such a great way of just understanding people and how things work. So it's, I don't know, Dave, do you have thoughts about the psychology of all this piece of it?
So, well, I guess what I would say with that, thank you for that. Like, what I've found with some of the best results that I've gotten was really almost just kind of getting out of the way, like really letting my client tell the story of what happened to them, and finding, usually when I'm prepping my clients for, you know, their depositions, you know, of course, one of the common things we say is like, you want to just answer the question as it is asked, right? Don't reveal too much, you know, just answer, don't volunteer information. What I'll usually say to them is, I want that to be true for most things. But if there is a question that you get that's something like, well, you know, can you tell me kind of a specific way that this crash has impacted you? To really build out that story of like I can think, for example, of one client who talked about how, you know, they had been in a car crash and couldn't surf anymore after the crash. And, you know, that wasn't reflected anywhere in any medical record, was not something that would have been asked in the typical deposition. But when he was really able to kind of reach in and talk about how it wasn't just the loss of that physical ability to surf, but the loss of that community of surfing, the loss of these people that, you know, again, maybe almost what we were talking about at the start, it's not that you, you know, would go and be best friends with all these people you see in the lineup every day, But just getting out there, having that sense, that loss, that that's a real, it's those sorts of intangibles that I think that really gripped the, as soon as I kind of had the defense lawyer hearing that story, I mean, I know that that's what got that case resolved. Finding those human moments, finding those human parts of the story.
It's interesting, Eric, when you were talking about, like, you know, the perception of the jury, and that was one of the things that led to my decision to settle my case was, you know, I was talking to my lawyer about strategy and, you know, but also this bias against cyclists. Like, most drivers hate cyclists because you're in the way and you can slow traffic down. And there's a lot of people that do stupid things. You know, my incident, I was in a bike lane. I had the right of way. Someone hit me, you know, very different from, but, you know, there's also a bias against people that are riding motorcycles, you know, and so that knowing that there's that bias is, you know, was part of the decision making for me in settling my case instead of taking it to trial. But, you know, then at mediation, I did my own damages presentation and talked to the adjuster directly and said, hey, you know, well, one, do you really want to put a lawyer on the stand who gets the opportunity to explain all the ways that this impacted my life? You know, because I had pretty significant injuries. I was in ICU for 9 days and 21 days in the hospital. So, and 3 months with my jaw wired shut with a severely broken jaw. And anyway, you know, like all those things, getting the opportunity to say it directly to the adjuster, I think was, you know, influential in ultimately getting, you know, them to pretty much tender the policy on, and it was my UM because, of course, like in most states, you know, here our minimum coverage is low and the guy who hit me had 10 grand in coverage, of course. So my medical bills alone were, you know, over $350,000, I think, somewhere in that ballpark. So anyway, it's just interesting, you know, that all of those things, what goes into each and every case, those factors, you know, play into the strategies that ultimately you've got to deploy to influence whoever's involved in that case, whether it's the jury or whether it's, you know, at mediation, getting to the decision maker is going to write that check.
Right. Well, yeah. And I mean, this is the psychology just off the charts. I remember reading your first book, and I've read your second book too, but reading your first book and then hearing about you having a cycling crash. And that was when I was getting into cycling and I was like, maybe I should talk to Jason before I get deeper into this. But, you know, so much of it, to put it in the insurance lab, so much of it is based on risk. And so, like, where the plaintiff is like, hey, we're going to cut you a check and it's going to be a discounted check, but then you get this, you know that this is what you're going to get and you get to be done with it. Okay, great. But then if you did want to, or if a plaintiff wanted to take it on the other side, it's what's the risk to the insurance company? And in California, UIM is different because maybe the policy isn't open to where you can, like, get a verdict that's over the policy and still collect on it. There's a few ways to approach it. But if it's a third party type case, you know, the risk can be that if you don't settle the case, you, the insurance company, if you don't settle the case, then we're going to ask a jury for, you know, whatever. And so many of the people that we deal with, especially like in a death case would be a great example. It's like there's no amount of money that's going to bring anything back. And so to be able to put that in the lap of the insurance adjuster, of just be like, there is a piece of us that wants to settle the case, us being the plaintiffs, like, because they want to be done with this, but they want to feel like they're respected with us. And if you don't respect the process and if you don't respect the clients, like, they're not going to want to settle, period. And, like, what do they care? They go to, you know, they go to trial. Like, it just resolved a wrongful death case at mediation, wherein it was like, either we go to trial and, like, I'm definitely going to be able to prove negligence on this case, and the jurors are going to award some money, and these people, it was a wrongful death case, so it's not like any kind of money, like, here's 100 grand, like, that's going to bring back the death. But I tell you what, like, if the jurors come back and they have a lot of, like, we really knock it out of the park, like, you have a ton of risk that you're dealing with. So, you know, what do you want to do with this? So, and then I think that's what a lot of plaintiff lawyers, it was a big thing for me to learn, is just how to be able to present this theory of risk on the insurance companies. Cause it's like on a really severe case, like, yeah, the plaintiff may lose. Okay. I got that. Or maybe not get a big verdict or something, but, you know, the insurance companies have a ton of risk, and then it's not just the risk of the money. Like, they have to cut a check. it's that the adjuster evaluated the case wrong or pursued the case in the wrong way. Like there's so many, like the internal office politics that go with insurance companies, I'm sure is off the charts. And I used to use that a lot when I was doing criminal cases, is that you got the entire district attorney's office that was like watching someone try the case. And I had a plenty of dismissals like in the middle of trial. Cause it's like, you could just like, this case is going really good for me. You could dismiss it. And that would be on your watch. You're making the decision, or it could be a verdict in my favor. And then you have to go, you know, head hung low and go talk to your superiors as to like what happened, like, how did you lose a case? So that's the next step that, I think 2026, 2025, there's a lot of trials that we're getting prepared to put together. So Dave, maybe you and I will try a case in 2025 and we'll tuck and roll. We'll get the stuff pushing forward. But this is, Jason, this goes back to your initial questions of like, how do you set cases up? And like, this is the stuff, these are the questions and the conversations having with the client in the very beginning so that the client knows that we're going to set this case up. Like they're at some point they will offer you something. I assume it's going to be a low ball offer. So let's talk about that now, if that's really what you want. Or am I starting to empower the client to understand this is where everything that's happening, and then, you know, go to trial. But it's also trust too with the client, with the lawyer, because, you know, so many plaintiff lawyers don't have the time or can't take the time or don't take the time to spend the time with the client. So then when it comes time of, I think that X is a reasonable settlement offer for your case, you know, if the client's like, I don't trust you, or I don't trust the process with that. So, but it's just a ton of time and a lot of resources that go into getting to that point.
I wanted to ask you guys about technology and AI, because there's been so much press on it, but also, you know, hype, and you're seeing a lot of development of different tools. I'm curious if there's any specific tools that you find most effective for either trial prep or the management of your cases. Hopefully you're not writing briefs with chat, because we all know some lawyers. Well, there's one in particular that did it and figured out that chat doesn't do legal citation. It makes up cases, which is probably not a good thing.
You know, we've done a couple of presentations. That's Mata v. Avianca. You can look that case up on Court Listener. It is a very entertaining series of documents in that case. You know, entertaining for us now. We'd be very happy that we were not the lawyers who had to go and get that record. but yeah, I mean, I think that AI is going to, I mean, there's a reason that every company is jumping in and, you know, trying to incorporate that into the practice now, right? I think that it is going to be transformative to what we do. Already just in the past few years, ChatGPT has really just kept on taking leaps and bounds. It's really incredible what you can put in and what it will output to you. I know our firm, we are just getting on board, with, Westlaw Precision and kind of their new AI software. I haven't had too much chance to play around with that. Have you, Eric?
Mm-mm. No, not yet.
See, we're old school over here. What are we doing? But yeah, no, like it's absolutely, I'm fascinated by what it's going to do. I remember when I used kind of an early version of one of these AI legal softwares, and I just typed in, you know, write an opposition to a motion for summary judgment based on, you know, a slip and fall at a restaurant. And what it gave me it was not, you know, 100% there, maybe not 90%, but it was 80% there. And if we think about this, where the way that we are in AI, it's kind of like using email in 1995 is I think where we are right now. It's going to just keep growing by those leaps and bounds. So I absolutely think that it's a tool that every plaintiff's attorney has to be using, because guess what? Every defense firm is using it right now. That's absolutely the direction that the practice is going. So it's something that, you know, it's worth being fluent in and learning with. So I look forward to seeing what we do with it.
Yeah. I think it's that, plus it's also like the fact that a computer can just read and like summarize things so well. So, you know, read this and summarize the key points, or read this and then tell us where there's inconsistencies within XYZ. You know, that's just so powerful. And that's where AI, I have seen it be really, really accurate. Read the Stepo transcript and, you know, give a list of every time that X is mentioned, and then any inconsistencies with that. Okay. That's helpful, you know.
For that, or I mean, even with what we have, I mean, putting together detailed medical summaries, some of what this program that we're looking at can do, it's just incredible.
Well, and yeah, there's some stuff that's been developed for demands for medical record summary. And I think eventually you'll see that bundled with retrieval. And, you know, there's certainly for us, we've been exploring, and because we go through volumes of plan documents for ERISA plans, for example, and you're really just looking for subro clauses and making sure that then the arguments are crafted correctly based on the subro language. And there's certainly opportunities from, you know, machines to do some of that heavy lifting before you have to have a person actually do the one-on-one, because there's obviously many things that it just will never do, right? It's going to be, how does it make our practices or make our companies more efficient in the way they operate? You know, that's really where I think ultimately this all ends, is it makes your practice in the personal injury world more efficient. It makes us more efficient in the way we process our work to be done. And how do we, you know, deploy it in a way that also protects us, right? I mean, there's certainly some risks in putting information into, you know, large learning apparatuses that we're all using, right? I mean, we know that. So there is also that security risk as well, particularly like medical information, right? I mean, like, so, you know, ultimately it's going to be interesting to see how it gets deployed and how you ultimately will leverage that in your space and how we ultimately leverage it. Which actually brings me to the last question I was going to ask you before we wrap up, because talking about efficiency, I'm curious in terms of your practice, how do you determine which aspects of a personal injury case that you focus on internally versus tasks you find it essential to outsource to others who might excel in that area? So there's a little bit of self-interest in that question, because obviously we work together on the lien resolution. So, but I'm curious, you know, holistically, how do you evaluate how your firm operates to make sure that you've got your team focused on the most important tasks and making sure that you've got the right experts that are supplementing your team to get to the right result for your client?
Yeah, great question. I can take lead on this question. And it brings up, so one of the recent podcasts, Jason, that you did was with Mike Morse, and I was really enjoying, besides the fact that I stopped the podcast several times to download the books on Audible that he recommended, or that he was an author of one of the books, that Fireproof book. But he talked about that he's really good at certain things, but then he is totally fine with being okay not being good at everything. And that, especially in this like lean resolution world. So like when I read your first book, it was exactly what I thought it would be. And if people haven't read that, I really recommend that you read it. Because if you think that you're doing lean resolution, read your book, especially when you're talking about the Medicare, Medicaid type stuff and how dangerous, like there's so many landmines with that. And, you know, I feel like that I and our firm and Dave, like we're all really good about putting a case together, telling the client story. That is a totally different skill set, in my opinion, versus of doing a lien resolution, because that incorporates like knowing the players that are behind the scenes and all that stuff that you talked about earlier, Jason, and having the credibility and knowing all the code language, all that kind of stuff. Like it would take so much resources to really just understand that stuff to be able to present it. So, and if I don't need to use either my resources, me, or my team's resources with my paralegal and some other people to do lien resolution, and if I can just give it to someone that I trust, and we work a lot with Synergy, which I'm very thankful for, it's a way for me just to know that everything's getting taken care of at a very high level. I don't need to worry about what's happening. Your team is also really great about being proactive with like feeding information without us having to ask for it. And then that allows us then to update the clients like, hey, this is what's happening. And that just puts a nice, like it just lands the plane so well that the client is happy with how the case is resolving, but then we still need to do the lien resolution part of it. But then they just know that everything's getting taken care of. And it's a very easy conversation for me to have with the clients of, this is what we're going to do. We're going to retain Synergy on this because this is what they do. Just the way that you want me to be focusing on proving your liability and telling your injury story. You want someone else that's really focused on, or I want someone that's really focused on doing lean resolution so that I can then free up the time to do other stuff. But that doesn't mean like just pick any company, just have them do it. Cause there's other versions of you, Jason, that's out there. And, you know, vet the companies, and it's a trust relationship. And, Brandon, who's been really great to work with your office, and the fact that you're also very supportive with all the different legal organizations and supporting and sponsoring and just being present with all the different organizations, like what you have built as a business model is just really admirable. And it makes it a very easy decision to be able to continue to work with you and your team. So thanks for what you're doing. Keep doing it.
Well, one, thank you. Two, I've got a check. I'll sign it and get it off the end. I really appreciate your comments. It's amazing to me that more law firms are not analyzing their practices like what you just talked about, which is, you know, what's the highest and best use of staff time, paralegal time, lawyer time? Because if you really look at that, you know, ultimately anytime your paralegal or even a lawyer in the firm spends on hold with Medicare, for example, that's certainly not the most efficient use of any of that kind of time. It's better spent enhancing the value of the cases that you got in your filing cabinet or in your electronic filing cabinet to make sure that you're maximizing the recovery for the client, which obviously also translates into more revenue for the law firm, and then taking the money that you save and spending it on marketing or technology deployment within the firm. I mean, it's unusual for us to hear, hey, we're using one of your competitors. More often it's, we've always done that ourselves. And, you know, the idea of, well, how does a law firm operate so efficiently and profitably and deliver for their clients? Well, it's evaluating everything. That's kind of what, you know, Mike Morse was talking about. I had Rob Levine on the podcast recently too. His episode's coming out, and he's built all these companies for himself, which are now actually serving other personal injury firms because of those ideas, like a medical record retrieval company, an outsourced offshore team for personal injury law firms, things that are about the efficiency and profitability of the operation of the law firm, which is really what, when you boil it down and look at what we do, it's that and takes the liability off the firm because, like you said, having to understand and all the nuances when it comes to, for example, Medicare, knowing the difference between, you know, Part A and Part B, traditional Medicare versus an Advantage plan, which, oh, by the way, these Advantage plans can sue personal injury firms for double the lien amount if you happen to miss that particular lien. So there's just so many landmines in those areas that it's surprising to me how few firms really have completely explored and then bought into this outsourcing model.
Well, and it also, that by relying on the work that you all do, then that allows us to then pursue the other cases and seek like more complete justice and more money for our other clients. And then that, what that does is then that means that we can do our work, try more cases, like really prepare cases the right way, the cases that are going to settle. And then that helps all of our other clients too, because then the insurance companies, like the defendants, like they never know the case settles and then we got a reduction of a lien of whatever X percent. Like that never hits their filing cabinet. But what hits them is like, oh, this firm knows what they're doing. They got their case put together. They're taking a lot of depositions. Like they're prepared for trial. They just tried, you know, four cases last year or whatever. And like that's, so if I can rely on someone else that I trust to do that, then that means that I can do more trial stuff and more just putting cases together. And then that's going to help not just that one client, but like all the other clients. And hopefully like the more that like Dave does that, then the more that I do that, then it, you know, our firm, we're very fortunate that we already have a really great name that was built on, you know, Dave's grandfather and just all the wonderful people that have been here. But let's keep it going so that these people continue to know, like, yep, there continues to be a new wave of people that are just coming through. And we just keep relying on you, Jason. You have your team do your part, and then that allows us to do our work.
Last question I always ask lawyers who come on the podcast. and this is completely open-ended, and whoever wants to say whatever, you guys can. And it's just simply, what's your view as a trial lawyer? So talk about whatever you want.
As a trial lawyer, I want to be able to, I want to hold people accountable. And I want to hold, it's not just people, because that's why so many people have such a negative view of plaintiff lawyers, is because they think that we're taking money out of the pockets of like actual other people, like your neighbor. You're suing your neighbor. Like, we're not suing your neighbor. Usually we're suing the insurance company. So like, I want to hold insurance companies accountable for mistakes that they've made, and whether it's intentional or not intentional or whatever, or gross negligent, but I want to do it the right way so that I'm being honest with the client, but also with, I want to do it with the power of knowing the background that we have at this firm, and also the background that we have each day of what we have done and earned for ourselves, to know that we just know how to do really great work. And I guess just to put it, maybe just to put it very succinctly, like I would want, like, if I was in a position to where I would need a lawyer, I would want someone that knew their way around the entire case and how to pursue the case, including dealing with like company like Synergy to be able to do lien resolution. But to know that this is going to be a case that's put together in a very smart way, that it's not just like, I don't want a lawyer that's just going to like pound the table and just scream and yell or be like, you know, sly. I just want someone that's going to be very honest and straightforward, but just know what they're doing, like really know like the areas of evidence, really know how to tell someone's injury story, to have the resources to be able to put, to talk to all the people, to be able to express the person's injury. Cause a lot of times you don't express it straight through the plaintiff. It's going to be through someone else, like a coworker or someone that they, you know, they see at a dog park or whatever. So as you can tell, I'm having a very hard time giving you a short answer with this, cause I have so many, so many thoughts and feelings on it. So with that, I'll just unplug and let Dave give some thoughts.
No, that was great, Eric. I mean, I really like the question. I mean, what I would say to that, my view as a trial lawyer would be, it's about compassion, and it's about the personal. In a lot of ways, I think of this as a Goldilocks job. There are a lot of people who go into the law because they maybe don't necessarily, you know, they always did pretty well at school, but they weren't into STEM work maybe. So this is where they end up. And a lot of people do that and they end up being really miserable with what they do. You know, some, maybe the pay is good, but that you hate what you do for a living, or the hours are horrible. This is a job where, I get to come in every day and I get to help real people. And I always think about, you know, that kind of, when things maybe feel overwhelming in my own personal life, or if there's other things going on, doing this kind of work where I know that I'm at least taking a step to help this person this day, it means the world to me. When things can feel out of control, I kind of almost think of the kind of the parable of like the girl and the starfish. Do you know that one where, you know, you have, kind of, a bunch of starfish washed up on the beach, and there's, a little girl, you know, just countless starfish, unbelievable amount. No way you're going to save them all. But, you know, there's a little girl who's just picking up one at a time and throwing them back. And I think, you know, some people come over to her and say, you know, little girl, why are you bothering to throw the starfish back? You're never going to save them all. But she picks up one and throws it back and says, yes, but I saved that one. You know, I helped that person. That's what I feel with today. That's when I go to sleep at night. You know, the messages I get, knowing that I had a material impact helping a family. That's my view on what it means to be a trial lawyer.
Such a great point. And I wish that our clients that work with us got to see our teams, what the posts are about successes, because every time there's a success, it gets posted on our teams. Everybody talks about what that means as it relates to our mission, which is helping injured parties and their families to protect the net recovery. And every month when we do our all hands, we go through a couple of cases and talk about what happened to the plaintiff, how we're helping, just so that the team understands the importance of what we have the privilege and opportunity and get to do, which is help people in what we do. And you guys are exactly that same thing. And that's one of the beautiful things about being in this world is knowing that we get to make a positive impact. We're part of an ecosystem that does something good for people that have been through something, you know, pretty difficult for the most part, or even horrific. You know, I mean, obviously you guys know, you've seen the cases, and you know, some of these are just such difficult situations, and knowing that we get a part in helping make it even just a slightly better situation is a good feeling, at least, you know, for me and our team. I know that that's the case. And I would imagine that, you know, for you guys, it's even more so because you've got that more direct connection.
Yeah, totally.
How can listeners get in touch with you guys if they've got a case in your neck of the woods, they want to co-counsel or refer to you guys? What's the best way to get in touch with you?
Our website, cglaw.com, or you can just Google Casey Gary California Law or Casey Gary San Diego Law Firm. You'll be able to find us.
Well, we'll include a link to the firm in the show notes for today's episode. David and Eric, thank you for the gift of your time today. I appreciate you being with me on the podcast.
Yeah, killer. Thanks, man.
Thank you so much, Jason. This was a pleasure.
All right, we'll see everybody on the next episode of Trial Lawyer View.
Here is another episode of Trial Lawyer View. We hope you enjoy today's guest and discussion. Tune in to our next episode for more helpful insights from fellow trial lawyers and practice experts. This podcast is brought to you by Synergy. Visit partnerwithsynergy.com to learn more about how Synergy can free your firm to focus on what it does best.